All right, here it is. My name is Bromo. It's the 13th of April here in Bismarck. It is sunny out, and we are projected to be in the 70s, like 73 degrees. And when that happens, and this will be the first time in months, like maybe 4 or 5 months, we've seen weather in the 70s, there's usually a parade that goes down Main Street. It's just everybody's all giddy, and weather is warming up. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 2/17/09. I am not an expert, and I tell that every time I'm on my podcast because I want people to know I don't have any kind of certificate. My only strength is that I have experience, 15 years of it, and my other strength is my guest that I have on. And I am fortunate enough and pleased to have my next guest on that I've been trying to get on, when I was living in Minot. And for years and years and years now, she and I met through a banquet about 4.5 years ago. Remember that, Cindy?
I do.
It was my privilege and honor to be invited out to be, I guess, the host, the dinner spokesperson, the leader of this Pathfinder Freedom Ranch thing. It was an honor for the Freedom Ranch. With all the Freedom Ranch people that have been there, and it was a gala that was. Do you know the name of that? I can say that simply enough. Do you know what that was?
I don't. I just remember it was the Freedom Ranch gala.
It was, and I met Cindy out there, and because we had been in correspondence, we were Facebook friends. We had never met in person, and she was kind enough to be all dolled out in a black dress. I think you were, and she was my date, and I wasn't looking too bad, except I had a hat on, which I've always said to myself, how dorky does that look? And it was a thrill. It was the greatest thing being around people that I had been through recovery with in San Diego. And we're talking recovery, and awards were given out. We had a great dinner, and that's the last time I saw you. You remember that, don't you?
I do.
Your name is Cindy. Now, I've never, in my history in this podcast, or maybe anywhere else, have interviewed somebody who's a full-fledged author. We'll talk about that in a second. Well, maybe more than a second, minutes away. But first, what is your sobriety date there, young lady? And what was your poison? What was your drink or drug?
My sobriety date is March 14th, 2010. So I just passed 14 years.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's a great start. Feels great.
Wasn't that the highlight of, I asked this of everybody, wasn't that the highlight of your year? Isn't that the greatest day of your life?
I don't know. I have grandchildren, so it is a wonderful day. It is a wonderful day. My family really, they love on me all year long, but, you know, they're proud of me. My children are proud of me. My mom's proud of me. Those who remember those dark days celebrate with me. Of course, my friends and my mentors, they all, but I really, you know, I mean, alcoholism, and you asked what my poison was. So for the last 10 years of my using, it was vodka. But of course, through the 25 years of my using, there was meth involved and marijuana and alcohol. But, for that last 10 years, it was really a love affair with the vodka bottle that I fell into, unbeknownst to me. It was, you know, I don't think any of us really start out intending to have these long bouts with alcoholism, but I do come from generations, both sides of my family, of alcoholics.
Yeah, I want to mention this real quick. Cindy just turned 87 years old, so she sounds very young, and I think that's awesome. So she has had many generations. But continue. I know what you're saying. When we first start out drinking, we're around our friends, and we're having fun, and it's not a big deal. Not at all.
Right. I don't think any of us start out, you know, intending to, you know, like having that first blackout and go, God, that was really a great experience. Let me do that again.
Yeah.
And I don't think, you know, I mean, in all truth, I don't think any of our stories are much different. You know, there are voids that we have. There are traumas that we experience, you know, whatever. I had a great childhood, but my parents did divorce when I was 10, you know, and so that kind of spiraled internally within me.
Did your parents drink?
Yes, my mom did not. My dad did.
Okay.
But my mom's parents drink, like alcoholic drink.
Right.
Right. And then, you know, like as the years went on, and of course, you know, in junior high, high school, we drink, like you said, with our friends, and it's fun and it's a thing to do. But then as the years went on, you know, and I met this man and he didn't drink, and that was so attractive to me.
Why?
Because I didn't want to be with somebody who was an alcoholic, or that was my thinking, you know, in the beginning.
Yeah.
So we went on to have 3 children, but I didn't know that it was just the alcohol. You know, he was not available. He was not responsible. He was a lot of things that I needed as a mom, you know, of children. So here I was, single mom, 3 children, just overwhelmed, angry, bitter, all of those things. Young, I was young. You know, and I think it's really true what they say, that where we start drinking or using, like, that's our emotional intelligence age. So if we're, you know, in our teens or in our early 20s, that, like, our emotional intelligence doesn't get a chance to mature.
Right. So what you're kind of saying is some people bloom late, some people start early.
Yes.
Some people have it in their genes, so to speak.
Yes, absolutely.
Admit, some people are around it with their whole family drinking, and it's no big deal when they're drinking around the house. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Big time.
Yeah. So then we end up getting stuck. I mean, in my opinion, we end up getting stuck in these behaviors that, you know, that aren't sitting well with our soul, doing things that we normally wouldn't do, having outcomes and consequences that we wouldn't wish on anybody.
Did you enjoy drinking when you started?
I mean, I think I did when I was in junior high and high school. I think that was fun. For most of my 20s, I did not drink at all. But then it was once I was really doing the whole single mom thing, and you know, I have a lot of energy. I wake up every day with a lot of energy. And
yeah, I'm gonna a couple of warnings here, and you've heard my podcast before. If I interrupt, I apologize for every single one of those.
No worries.
I do that because I don't want to lose my train of thought because my mind is so tiny as it is. But I'm going to paint a picture for all of you about Cindy. I'm 2 hours ahead. I'm Central Time, and I wake up early sometimes. And man, oh man, is she up early. And she wasn't kidding when she says that. She's up by 3:34. She's already 4 o'clock in the morning. She's already done her calisthenics or whatever. She sits down and meditates for 45 minutes. She'll go around. She'll go do this, go do that, go clean the her house, vacuum cleaning. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to wake you up. I forgot that it's 4:15 in the morning and I've been up for an hour, you know. She'll do some reading, and she and I are completely different that way. And I will always say to her, "Why are you up? Why are you up so early?" So yeah, I just want to set that for everyone to know a little bit about you. So go ahead, continue.
Well, you know, and that's a thing. Like, I was always up early, you know. So as a single mom, knowing I didn't have much, you know, I was. I wanted to be a good mom. I wanted to be a good employee. None of it was happening. And so I would be up so early. And, you know, because I have all this energy, I didn't really know what to do with it. So probably like when I was about 29, 30, I had a drink, you know, thinking, okay, let me just calm my nerves, get my thoughts straight, and really try to do this mom thing. Well, you know, that works for a while until your body starts needing the alcohol.
Yeah. Oh, boy, yeah.
And then once your body starts needing the alcohol, it is game over because it has control.
Now, were you working at this point? You were working.
I did. I did a little bit. I went to school for a little while, and then I, you know, put that on hold. And then I went. I did have a job for a while. One job I had when my kids were, my boys were young. They were probably like, I don't know, 2 and 3 years old. They're only 16 months apart. And my daughter was in school, so I would take her to school and I would take them to daycare. And one of the responsibilities I had was leaving the office around 11 o'clock each day to drive over to the next, it was about 15 minutes. But I would drive over to the post office and pick up all their orders to bring them back and put them into the system, you know?
Yeah.
Put them back, data entry. Anyway, I remember vividly the day that I left the office. And instead of going left to go to the post office, I took a right. And I took a right, and I was like, okay, there's got to be a liquor store here
somewhere.
Let
me guess. I was just going to say.
Yes.
There's a point in the book where that guy who hadn't had a drink in years did the same thing on his way home. It was calling you. It was testing you.
It was testing me, and it was taking over my life.
Yeah.
I didn't, and again, I don't think any of us really want to get ourselves in those situations, but it's a disease, and it was taking over my life. And I remember that day, and I found the liquor store, and, you know, there's so much thought that goes into it. I would imagine it's the same thing as, like, somebody who uses needles, how they, like, the whole preparation of getting the drug and using the drug, but it was the same thing for me. It was like, okay, what am I going to mix it with, and what kind of gum am I going to get? Like, it just became this whole, it was just madness, you know?
What did you say? Did you say mix it with what kind of, did you say gum?
No, what was I going to mix it with to drink it?
Yeah.
And then, like, what kind of gum so that when I get back to the office, then I can, you know, pretend to act normal.
No, but you did say gum, G-U-M. What kind of gum am I going to get?
Yeah, like, what am I going to cover the smell with when I get back to the office?
I don't think that ever came into play for me, I walk in the liquor store. All right, two things. One, where's your booze? Where's your gum?
Right. I have this friend, and many years ago when we first got clean, we were talking about how we would keep, like, we always tried to prepare ourselves in case we ever got pulled over.
Yeah.
So in my console, this was many years ago, obviously, but I had a little Tupperware thing of peanut butter in case I ever got pulled over, thinking that the peanut butter would cover the vodka.
Wow.
And my friend told me she used to carry around an onion, if you can believe that, in her console, so that if she ever got pulled over, she would take a bite of the onion and the cop wouldn't smell it. But
yeah, well, ironically, now Cindy works today as a Wrigley Spearmint chewing gum representative. She
Correct.
Goes all around the country.
Absolutely.
Well, so what that basically, to be serious now, what she just said, and Cindy, maybe you can back me up on this, it's called preparedness. We're getting ourselves prepared, like you said, for our disease. We want to know where our booze is, and we want to know, like, where the gum is for our breath, because we know people can smell that. For me, it was my booze, the ice for the cooler, and such. I had my preparedness going on.
Right.
I love it.
You know, and speaking of preparedness, I don't think anything prepares us for what actually happens when your disease just takes over your life, you know?
Well, so, you know, I don't think you had any idea back then.
I had no idea. And, you know, my heart wanted to, like I said, my heart always, I mean, I'm a genuine person, naturally a genuine person. So it was never that I wanted to be this employee that was drinking or this mom that was drinking or, you know, because it all just falls, you know, it all just goes downhill when the alcohol becomes the most important thing in your day.
And say that again. When the alcohol, say that again.
When it all goes downhill, whatever you're attempting to do, whether it's parent, be an employee, be a wife, be a whatever. I've never been a wife, but I would imagine it's the same thing. Everything that you are intending to work out well, it all goes downhill when alcohol becomes the most important thing of your life.
And that couldn't be more true.
Yes.
I couldn't be more true. That is so true.
Yeah, so as time went on, you know, and from that job, I don't know how over the years people never noticed or they didn't want to notice. I mean, I was still getting the work done. I was still being, you know, showing up on time, never calling in sick. That job, I ended up excusing myself one day. I just figured I'd go home and tend to the most important relationship that was happening in my life, and that was my relationship with the vodka bottle.
So would you label yourself back then as a functioning alcoholic?
For the beginning of it, I would say.
Okay.
Maybe in my early 30s, but it soon took a drastic turn, you know.
Oh, like it always does. But you knew that. You knew what that meant, functioning alcoholic. You'll hear people say, I think Bob is a functioning alcoholic.
Right.
You know, you'll hear that around any kind of business, really, a lot of places, sadly.
Right. Well, and, you know, and I don't think it always has to be somebody that doesn't have a job or somebody that's blacking out every day. I mean, today I know, you know, and this is after doing a lot of internal work and a lot of soul searching.
Yeah.
That if you're, the things that really matter to you aren't growing and blossoming, then the alcohol might be getting in the way.
Well, everything else is getting in the way. When I was drinking, the alcohol was my only, as my old counselor would say, my lover. That was my lover. Did you see your lover? Did you have your lover around? Yes. Yes, I know how you're going. That was your boyfriend, girlfriend, your lover. Alcohol was the first that you needed to take care of.
Yep. I mean, but that's where, you know, those of us who are lucky enough and blessed enough to have some clean time, we get to see, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, we get to see that, that was true. That is true. The alcohol was more important than most things.
And boy, isn't that one of the steps of the 12 steps when it comes down to being honest? You know, that's what you'll learn as you take the road of the 12 steps. But continue.
Oh, where was I?
Well, you just took that turn where you should have gone left. You went right. You took some booze, and then you took care of that.
Yeah. So, you know, and then as the years went on, you know, I'd go to, my family knew. Like, my mom knew, and since she came from alcoholic parents, it terrified her.
How do you know that she knew? Did she say to you, hey, Cindy, I think you're drinking too much?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, but I tried to play it off like I got this. You know, I got this whole facade of I got this. Don't worry about it. I got this. I'm going to fix it. It's all going to be okay.
Did it ever make you mad? Because it used to make me mad when people
It made me very angry.
Yeah. I think
for
you got
years,
a,
my,
yeah,
for
I,
years,
I think you got a problem. You know, something like that.
Yeah.
Romo, come here. do you think maybe you have a problem? What's my problem?
Yeah.
I'm going to work. Oh, I know you are. But I know you're also drinking. Do you think you have a problem? But that made you mad, didn't it?
It did. You know, for years, my mom didn't hug me without inhaling as she got near me to hug me.
Oh, wow.
She would take a big, deep breath to see if she could smell alcohol on me.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there's so many aspects to once we get clean and once we can see the reality of what the alcohol was in our life. But, you know, us addicts, alcoholics, we're very strong, smart,
cunning,
defensive,
cunning
in our using, defensive.
Yep, cunning.
But we're also very sensitive people, you know?
Well, speaking of sensitivity, I remember talking about your mom and the characteristics I think that you may have picked up from her is, when we were at our banquet, you refused to hug me at the end of the night. And I go, look, I haven't had a drink. And she goes, and Cindy goes, I know, I just don't feel like hugging you.
Did I say that? I don't remember.
Heck
saying
no,
it.
I was making a dumb joke.
Oh.
I was making a dumb joke.
You know, so let me tell you, as the years went on, you know, and trying to, and being a single mom.
Yeah.
And I'd like go to the boys, like the teachers at the school, they'd say, hey, do you want to work a carnival booth? And I'd be like, sure.
Yeah.
You know, so thinking, and I guess that's where the real, you know, it's just complete denial. Like, okay, if they're going to ask me to work a booth at the school, I must be okay. You know, and the boys' baseball coach would be like, he'd throw the stat book at me. Hey, can you take stats for the game? I'm like, sure. But like, little did they know that my Gatorade bottle had vodka in it, you know?
Yeah. Right.
So it's just that whole facade. And like I said, those of us that are blessed enough to be on the other side of it, I don't know. It's just really amazing to be sober, to be able to, you know, rebuild the trust with my family.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second, but getting back to this real quick. In that phase of Gatorade bottle with booze in it, that's the hiding phase. That's when the dangers and the horrors in your head are like, God, do you think they know? I mean, do you think I'm fooling everybody? You weren't fooling your mom, of course, and maybe some other close people, but when you're out in functions and stuff and being asked to work at a carnival booth, but you're drinking because you don't want to be without it and you're hiding it in a Gatorade bottle, that's one of the fears as well of drinking.
Absolutely.
Am I fooling everybody?
Well, and you know, for me, it was always just so crushing. It was I guess it really didn't matter if I was fooling everybody. I was letting myself down.
Yeah, but I think it did for a while. I think it did. I think you were scared that other people were going to catch wind, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's part of when we are in our disease and our mind is telling us, hey, man, I'm loving this effect of the booze. I need it. My body needs it. But the other part of me is saying, God, I hope nobody can smell this on me. I hope I'm not slurring my words. I hope nobody knows what I'm doing. And only a few know. And the few that do know, and they do eventually come up to you and say something to you.
Right.
It's pretty amazing that they take that effort to do so, you think?
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
Anyway, continue. Like I said, I interrupt too much, and I probably take off your train of thought. So when people are asking you to do stuff for events and keeping stats for a baseball game and you've got your booze there, you are saying you feel a little bit bad about yourself for what you're doing, right?
Absolutely. I would see these other moms and, well, most of them had their partner with them, so it'd be their mom and their dad. And, and here I came with this frickin' attitude. It wasn't a bad attitude, but it was also, you know, I mean, there is strength in being a single mother that you just grow within you, you know, like it's the mama bear. Nobody's going to hurt my babies. Nobody's going to hurt us. I've got this, you know, it's this, and it just grows throughout the years that, I don't know. It's hard to explain, but you know, as time went on, my family, they started really getting worried. Started trying to intervene, started trying to do this, started trying to do that. Like, you know, my mom would be like, oh, I'm just going to take the boys for the weekend or, you know, and then holidays started becoming a nightmare.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever have an intervention thrown at you?
I did. Funny you should ask. 2007.
Do you feel comfortable telling us about it?
Sure. My dad was always pretty unavailable, like emotionally, in our lives. He wasn't a grandpa that like took the kids for the weekend or anything. So he was, he had called me one day and he said, hey, don't forget you have that appointment tomorrow. I was like, well, what are you talking about? You know, of course I was with my drinking buddy and we were just hanging out and, he said, well, if you want me to take you to it, I can pick you up. We can go to lunch and I can take you to your appointment. I was like, you know, and in my mind, I'm like, well, of course I want to go to lunch with my dad.
Yeah.
I should have known. But of course I was beyond drunk every day. So he picks me up and we go eat and he takes me to this appointment. When we walk in, it was actually at the social services office, you know. when we walk in, I said, okay, well, I'm just going to go talk to him. And he goes, no, I'm going to go in with you. I go, you don't have to go in with me. And he goes, no, I'm going to go in with you. So we walk into this room, and there's my whole family.
Oh, my God.
Mom, my stepdad, my sister, my best friend from high school.
Oh, wow.
One of my children's father's sister-in-law, three social workers.
Holy moly,
Yeah, and my daughter. Of course, my daughter, she was already 18 at that time. And I just put my, I was blown away. I mean, of course I was drunk. I mean, really drunk. I used to have these little jean skorts. Do you know what skorts are?
Skorts?
Skorts.
What are they called?
They're little shorts that have a skirt.
Oh,
they're
a short.
Skorts.
Okay. No, I don't know.
God, I had these jean skorts that I would throw on a tank top, and I live in San Diego, so it's like always sunny.
Yeah.
Anyways, I can remember distinctly what I was wearing that day. Anyway, I walk into this room, and the tears just, I couldn't even believe. I was offended that my family had not come to my house to check on me,
Yeah.
And I was offended that they were taking this action.
Yep.
So that day, I had the choice. I could either temporarily sign over the boys to my, the boys were still in elementary school, so I could either temporarily sign them over to my mom or CPS was going to get involved.
Let's pause right there. For those of you who listen to my podcast, and I really appreciate it, and for those of you who are normies, a normie is someone who is not compelled to drink or use every day and can have a beer in the refrigerator, be there all week long and not take it. If you've heard of an intervention, if you've seen it on TV, this is exactly what Cindy is describing right now. I've never had it happen, and this is why I'm so, my ears perked up when I asked you that question. When you were proposed with this, the situation, when you walked in and you saw all eyes on you and all your family members and friends, you knew immediately what it was?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I could go into more detail. So they had the table.
Yeah.
They had, the tables in, like a horseshoe shape so that we were all looking at each other,
Yeah.
They had these cardboard name cards, right? So everybody had their names so that the social workers knew who they were talking to. And, and of course I'm making jokes like where is the hidden camera? Like, this has got to be a joke. And I'm saying, everybody keep your name card. I'm going to keep them for my scrapbook. I mean, I was drunk and I was scared and I was horrified that everything that even taking that right turn to go to the liquor store 10 years prior had led up to this.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Just that one right instead of a left, or a left instead of a right.
Absolutely.
Like a little tinder block, it all added up.
Absolutely.
Now, the situation was posed to you about your kids. Say that again.
It wasn't an option. I had one of two choices. My mom go. Yeah, I had one of two options.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm telling her, well, you raised me, and look at how I turned out, and just drunk and mouthy.
Now, were people allowed to make comments all around the room? Was it structured?
Oh, sure.
Was it like a free form structure? Like, hey, I'm worried about you. Hey, Cindy, yep. We know what's going on, and you're looking all around, and all eyes on you.
Yes.
Are you embarrassed and ashamed, angry?
Absolutely. I wanted to go home. I needed a drink.
Yeah.
I wanted to go home, and I needed a drink.
That's what I want to ask you. When you were brought in there, and then the situation was this, you don't have a choice. The whole thought through your mind is, I'm gonna, and when can I drink again? I need it so bad. Did that keep in your head?
Absolutely. I mean, well, I knew. I mean, by that time, the vodka was ravishing my body.
Okay.
So I knew that I had, at this point, it had been, from the time we walked in the room, it had been an hour and a half since my dad picked me up. So I knew I had about 2 hours before I was going to start shaking.
Oh, so you had shakes at this point?
Oh, yeah.
And let me tell people real quick about the shakes and see if Cindy agrees. I would wake up, and within 20 minutes, if I'm at work, I'd shake so much. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, I wonder when I'm going to stroke out in this building. I'm walking down the hallway. I go to the bank one time. Wow, are you okay? I'm shaking to sign a check. Oh, yeah. I almost got hit by a car walking across the street. Oh, my God. The shakes are the worst thing that I went through. And for me, and let's see if this is for you, the shakes would only go away with my second gulp into my second big tall glass of vodka. Then I calmed down and the shakes were gone.
Yes.
So you went through the shakes. You had the shakes. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, all the time.
Yeah, it's the most violent, scary. I remember thinking, shakes are never going to leave me.
Right. They do. Thankfully, they do.
So at this intervention now, you weren't ready to just say, look, I surrender. Get me help. I'm never going to drink again. This wasn't at that point, correct? You had to fight
That's what I did do. I didn't want it to be under those conditions, but the help was there. I took it. You know, they weren't going to. My whole thing was, I've got to get my boys back.
Right.
I've got to get my boys back.
Yeah, but see, the alcohol doesn't want you to get your boys back. The alcohol.
Oh, of course not.
No, the alcohol wants everything to stay the same.
Absolutely. And get worse.
And this is the scary part, right?
Yes.
And you weren't ready to quit. You wouldn't have quit if this intervention was held.
Well, you know, actually, I don't know what would have happened. I'm not sure exactly what would have happened. But if you ask my daughter today, who's early 30s, she said, Mom, you were always trying to get clean.
Now, how so? You would tell her?
Because I mean, over those 10 years, you know, I would ask my mom. I said, okay, I need help. So she would watch the kids for a week. I'd go to detox. And then I'd start going to meetings, and I'd try to do that whole thing. Self-help meetings, you know, and really develop a support group. But then it'd be like 3 months in and I'd smoke some weed thinking that it would never lead back to the alcohol.
Yeah.
But it always did. So
boy, detox is a lot of fun, isn't it?
Summer camp for adults.
What was that, hyper train, something train, they give you, at the end of the night that says it helps you sleep.
Librium?
No, it's something. We called it something train.
I don't know.
It was some pills they gave me at McDonald's Center, and we would all line up, and they would tell you that it would help you sleep at night. But so you've gone through detox. How many times in your drinking
detox?
Career?
Have I been through detox? Let's see. I've been through detox. Prior to the intervention, I think I'd gone 3 times.
Where did you go, if you want to say where you went?
Somewhere here in San Diego County.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you would go for a couple days of detox, 2 or 3 days, and then this was
already... And they usually had a 10-day program.
Yeah.
Most of them had a 10-day program connected to it. So then you do 10 days of, like, you know, drug and alcohol education and groups that you're, you know... that are supposed to magically cure you, but if the disease isn't done with you, it's not done with you.
Okay, quick question.
Yes.
And I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, and I'm not going to rat out these line of places, but for me, when I was assigned outpatient, underline that, where I could...
Go home?
I'm smart enough, and I figured out when they were... And I got to still live at home in Mission Beach, the Disneyland of booze. And for me, outpatient was a joke.
It can be.
It can be
if you're not ready.
And say that again. If you're what?
Not ready.
Absolutely.
Because here's the thing. I've been working in the behavioral health field, substance use field, for 13 years now. You know, and I love helping people. Obviously, I know what it's like to be in that situation. I love helping people. I love watching people be done with that lifestyle. But when and I will help anybody, you know, God puts people in my path even when I go to the grocery store. So it's something I enjoy doing. But sometimes when
even when you're looking for gum, hey, where's the gum aisle?
Sometimes when people ask, hey, I have a sister that needs help, or hey, I have a so-and-so that needs help, my first question is, do they want help?
Yeah.
Because if you're not ready, you're not, nothing's going to work.
No, sadly, it's so true. Sadly, you could walk into a room of an intervention of one, and you look across the way, and God is sitting there, and God says, first of all, Bromo, you need a haircut. Second of all, my son, are you done? And don't lie to me. And if I'm not done, I would try to lie to him. I can tell you're lying there, son. You're not ready. You're not ready. Right. So outpatients, can be really a nice little maneuver on your own part, thinking, and you're telling everybody, I'm getting help. And you're lying through your teeth by drinking at home on a Tuesday because you don't have to go in until like Thursday afternoon, and then you know if they pee test you, you'll be fine.
Right. However, I will say that over the years that I've worked in the substance use field, outpatients do work when people are ready. And these days, compared to back in those days, there are so many resources available. So it's not just outpatient now.
Yeah.
Now they actually have so many collaborations with different resources in the community. It's not just you're going to go and I advocate for outpatients. I advocate for residential, definitely detox if you need it, especially with that fentanyl out there right now.
Yeah.
There's really no, I do know of people who have done the whole 10 days just getting themselves off it. I don't recommend it. Should definitely be medically observed at the very least.
Yeah.
Anyway, so from that day on, I'll make it brief. You can read it in my book that I've written.
Yeah, we're gonna hit on that real quick. But I have to rewind. Yes. I have to rewind real quick. Was that your one and only intervention? Your large one?
Oh, absolutely.
Now, in that intervention, you know you're losing your kids because you have that two options. Tell everybody again the options. One, you're gonna lose your kids.
My two options were to let my mom take them.
Yep.
Or to let the state get involved.
So what happened?
So that afternoon, let's see, after they all got done telling me how concerned they were and what they wanted from me and that I'd get the kids back after I had 6 months clean, they already had a bed for me at detox. So now we're talking, this intervention went on for 2 hours. And as I had mentioned, I had already been with my dad for an hour and a half. So we're 3.5 hours in from the last drink that I had.
Yeah.
So we're waiting outside. we're waiting outside for the Librium. And I don't know if you know what that is, but it's like a pill that'll take the shakes away. It's like you give it to detox and they give it to you like once, 3 times a day. And it's supposed to for the DTs.
Do you know why I think I know that? Is because the second before the last time I relapsed, when I had a roommate, and my roommate called the counselor and said, he's drinking again. And the counselor said, all right, two things you need to do. Either A, take him to a hospital so he can get that you're
Librium,
saying.
Yeah.
Or if you have any of that around the house, get it to him now. Or you got to give him some booze now.
Absolutely.
And I remember thinking, hey, really? Booze?
Let's
booze it up. I got permission to booze? No, dude.
Right.
No, dude. You're walking the tightrope of having a heart attack and stroking out.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. So that intervention that you had took 2 to 2.5 hours. Were there a lot of crying? A lot of yelling? Huh? A lot of backpedaling against the wall with your back against the wall saying, why are you all doing this?
Yeah, and like I said, my daughter was already a young lady at that time, and I just had my head on her shoulder and cried and cried and cried and apologized. And
yeah.
Anyway, so at this point, we're waiting for the Librium, and the people at the pharmacy are out to lunch, so we're waiting for them to get back from lunch. We got about another half an hour. And I'm sitting in my dad's truck.
Yeah.
And I'm shaking so bad and sweaty, clammy, like uncomfortable. And yeah. I'm sitting on my hands that I was shaking so bad. I had them underneath my legs. And, you know, my best friend from high school, she comes and she pops her little head on the side of the truck and she looks in the passenger side and she goes, look what I brought you. And she had a Twix bar and a Dr. Pepper. And I was like, thank you, like trying to smile, like, but I couldn't even if I had wanted to eat that. Like, my hands were shaking so bad. I literally had them underneath me. So they get the medicine. They take me. They all say, bye. We'll check on you. Have a good time at detox.
Yeah.
And off I went. So, you know, for the next, well, that was 2007. I'll just wrap it up. I mean, I did stay sober for about a year and a half. And then I started, you know, hanging out with people that I knew I shouldn't have been around and all that great stuff. And I finally made it home to my family.
Yeah.
I mean, I got to see my children the whole time, but I was never in my own home with them again until I made it home February 2011 to them.
Let's...
And that's after I had almost a year sober.
Let's think crystal clear now, and I'm sure you can, because I can for me. Let's think and tell everybody in your head what went on when you relapsed for the last time, when you picked up that drink, or for me, when I walked into a liquor store without even buying it yet, I knew I had relapsed already because the intent was there. You could have had a national army at the front door, and I would have walked right on through them. Let's tell everybody that thought when you relapsed. Were you ashamed? Did you cry? Did you get scared? Did you think to yourself, here we go, it's all coming back again?
Yes, 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 and yes. I mean, it's that whole, in fact, I remember that last relapse, and I was, I had gone, you know, I was seeing this guy that I'd known for years and years, and he was a complete maniac, you know, but I was hanging out with him, and knew I shouldn't have been, and we had stopped at the gas station, and he handed me some money and said, hey, can you go in and pay? So I went in to pay, you know, whatever. He was going to put gas in his car. And I glanced over at, it was an AMPM.
Yeah.
And I saw a Mike's Hard Lemonade. And I was like, oh. Well, that won't, you know. Certainly a lemonade won't lead me back to the vodka again, right?
Yeah, right.
Certainly not. So I bought it, and I put it in my purse, and even he didn't know that I had bought it.
But you knew. You knew you were going to die.
I knew, and I just knew that, you know what, until those chains were broken, until something really, really drastic happened, like really, really happened, I just knew that it was just the vicious cycle, just going through it, you know.
Did you go on another run?
By that time, I was...
Again? Did you go on another run again? Did you drink for a while after that when you relapsed?
Sure.
You did?
Sure.
How much longer?
I mean, between 2007 and 2011, I think there was like... I think by 2009, I was probably drinking pretty steadily again until March of 2010 when I got clean.
So when you got clean that day, was it your own decision, or was it, did someone say?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay,
did you
go in and surrender?
I was done.
You went
in? Yeah, no, I can tell you about a night in the park. This part's actually in my book, about a month and a half before my clean date. No, actually, it was probably only like a month. But I was in that neighborhood where I was raising my kids, and the same little baseball field where my boys played baseball. And there was a little, you know, I had friends all over. I had my drinking buddy, and I had this couple that I used to hang out with. And then I had that psycho dude that I would date. You know, and that night I just didn't want to be with anybody. I just couldn't bring myself to go in anywhere. So I remember going, it was like 1 a.m. in not the best neighborhood. And I went and climbed up in that little kiddie thing. And I sat there, it was February. So it was fairly, I mean, I'm from San Diego, so when we say cold, it's definitely not North Dakota cold, but it was cold.
Yeah.
And I remember my having my jacket on, and I was cold. I was uncomfortable, and I remember, and I just said, Lord, whatever you're going to do with me, do it, because I am done with this. I am done with this.
Why? Why were you done?
Because I am capable of so much more. Let's just get back to the real fact. I could not stand to be away from my children another day.
Okay.
Not another day. Nor could I stand to hang out with those people another day.
Okay.
Absolutely. You know, and I had been trying for so many years to actually get some time put together, you know?
Yeah.
I liked myself better when I was sober. I liked life better when I was sober. Even though I drank I never got drunk again, but there were, you know, I would still like sip on, but it wasn't the drastic blackouts drunks that I had experienced previously.
Sure.
And then not even 3 weeks later, I remember one Saturday morning, I called my sister and I asked her, can you come get me? And then, 2 days later, I called this faith-based house, in San Diego County.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there, and I can tell you, Bromo, that God changed me from the inside out. Not only did he change me from the inside out, he healed every relationship in my life with my mom, you know, because I was pretty angry with her for taking my kids,
yeah,
although she was trying to help.
Yep.
But God healed all of that. You know, he just, and I hope I'm not getting too spiritual for anybody to stop listening, but I tell my clients over the years, like, whatever works for you. If it's self-help meetings, wonderful.
Yeah.
If it's surfing, great. If it's knitting, great. If it's a spiritual path, great. But whatever brings you peace, tap into it.
Higher power.
That's
higher power.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
This place that you went in that saved your life, is this the place that has pancakes, the deals for?
No.
Okay.
No.
I probably know what this place is, but I know you don't probably feel comfortable
that
about
place
saying.
Is mentioned in my book because they had tried to take me there a month and a half prior to that.
Okay.
Yes.
No sweat.
I ended up out in the middle of the desert having to call my friend to come get me. Yeah.
So
but that part is definitely in my book.
Now, you're in this place, and how long was this adventure you were inside this place for? How long were you there for?
And this place wasn't this place, although they consider it like a woman's home, it wasn't like any of the treatment places I had been to before. I remember getting there, and actually that place that you were talking about just a minute ago,
yeah,
that place that you were just talking about a minute ago didn't give you toilet paper. When you needed to use the restroom, they would give you a few squares, and you had to ask every time. So when I showed up to this place, my sister and my daughter took me up there. So I said, we got to stop at the store. I need cigarettes, toilet paper.
Yeah.
This is a true story. And I show up there, and the house mom comes out, and I told her, I said, do I need to bring my own toilet paper? And she looked at me. She said, for what?
Oh, yeah.
I just want to make sure that I don't have to ask for toilet paper. She goes, honey, you don't have to ask for toilet paper. Like,
yeah.
I just knew that I was, and you know, of course I get there and I'm like, my roommate got home and I said, when do I get my chore? Because I was so used to being in these places where they're like, oh, it's double scrub today. And
oh,
you know,
yeah,
kind of
yeah.
Like, right.
Yep, I had that happen.
And my roommate looked at me, she said, I don't know, when they decide that there's something for you to do, they'll give you a chore. And my chore for that whole year of being in this amazing refuge of a beautiful women's home was to unload the dishwasher every morning. That was
well, for some people, that's a difficult task.
Well, for some people, I knew that I was at a place where I was safe, where I could finally take a good, hard look at myself and my character flaws and what mattered to me and what I wanted, like what was my plan, you know?
Well, I can imagine that training day. All right, Cindy, your job is to unload the dishwasher. First of all, this is a fork. This is a fork. Unlike this is a spoon, and they go right. They go right over there. So you were in this place for a year.
Yeah, well, 11 months. Yes.
Let me ask you this: do you remember? And I'll bet you do. Do you remember where you were when you realized to yourself the obsession was lifted on you?
In the park that night. The next day after. No. I guess a couple of days after the park, I knew that the obsession had been lifted, but my body was still kind of needing, you know, to tame down off of the shakes.
Yeah. The obsession has
and
been
I guess
lifted.
It probably, no, I retract that statement. I guess it probably wasn't until I was in that home about a month or two, and people were talking about, God,
yeah,
I can't stop thinking about alcohol, or yeah, I can't stop. And for me, it was gone.
That's one of the gifts.
It was gone. I mean, like, for real, it was gone. Like, I was not going to turn back, and I didn't need to turn back. Like, I was so ready to, you know, mind you, I'm 40 years old at that point.
Yeah.
But I was just ready to live life on life's terms, if you will.
Well, that's one of the rewards right there. In your first year, it sounds like, of being sober, you got into the field of recovery, didn't you?
Yeah, that would be my second year. So, yeah, I was away from, but I got to see my kids all the time. Well, another thing about that women's home, since my boys were already over the age of 11,
yeah,
within a month, my the house manager let me come home to my mom's every other weekend.
Oh, nice.
Every other weekend, I'd get to come spend the whole weekend with my kids. And, you know, I'd take them to the movies. And little by little, they started feeling safe with me to get in the car with me.
Yeah.
To go somewhere with me, knowing that I wasn't going to screw up the, you know,
yeah,
the day or the the event by hitting the liquor store again. So, I mean, I never want to say that it was easy. It wasn't easy, but it was what my soul needed, and it was what my heart wanted, and I was not going to stop until I was either going to make it back to my kids or die.
So when was the idea planted in your head that you wanted to work in the field of recovery for a living?
Yeah, so pretty early on, once I got home to my mom's in 2011, there was a new class starting. And so, you know, I was cleaning houses, and that's how I paid for my school. And, you know, my stepdad at the time, he had had a couple strokes. Like, he had had a couple strokes maybe the 2-3 months before I made it back home. And, you know, I remember my mom sitting me down, and she said, you know, I need to talk to you, and I'm not sure if this is comfortable, but I need to take care of my husband.
Yeah.
And you move home and take care of the boys. So, I mean, within a, you know, for the first 3 nights when I made it home, my boys shared a room. They had twin beds, and they blew up an air mattress, and they said, Mom, come sleep with us.
Oh.
So they put the air mattress in between the two beds. I mean, like, this stuff to this day, 14 years later, it is so heartwarming to me because, you know, I knew that I was different. And not just different. I knew there was a lot of work to be done, but, you know, that first week, I would take them to school, I'd make the dinners, and it just all flowed. So within a couple months of being home, I think by August, there was a class, the substance use counseling class. So I decided to go to school. And a month into being in school, believe it or not, the same detox that I had been to so many times, they had a job opening.
Yeah.
And they hired me. And I couldn't even believe that a year and a half later I had keys to this place. It was just the most amazing, miraculous thing ever. And from there, let's see, I went and worked with teens. I've been a DUI counselor. I've worked with women and children. I've worked with men. I've worked with, I've done all sorts of things. And to this day, the greatest joy is watching these, the people that actually are ready. You know, I like to think of them as our flowers. We plant them and water them, love on them, and they just bloom.
Heartwarming, what you said earlier is so true. Heartwarming because you got your life back and you're watching your life go to you. You're watching yourself be in charge. You're watching yourself have not having to deal with alcohol over your head. Heartwarming. Absolutely. For the fact that you're watching others look at you with a new found respect as they watch each day goes by. Because I tell you, it's not automatic when you say to everybody, I'm done. I just got out of recovery here at Freedom Ranch. Come love me. Man, it might take some people a long time. Maybe some people never. Heartwarming is perfect when you say that term, because heartwarming is knowing that you don't owe a ton of money on something that you left unpaid for months, or that they're about to come repo your car. Heartwarming is warming, driving down the road knowing that you, if you get pulled over, you can say, "Hey there, officer, I haven't had a drink." You're in control. That's what heartwarming to me is all about. You said it perfectly. And what is your actual title of what you do? Do you mind me? Can you say that?
Right now, I am a program coordinator.
So
I do all sorts of things. I wear many hats. So,
do you ever wear a Padres hat? San Diego Padres?
I love the Padres, and I'll wear a Padre hat anytime I'm offered one, yes.
Well, I'm not going to give you one of mine, so don't even try it. Here's the thing about Cindy. How many people do you think in your career have come to you with that face and that look and that beaten-up body of theirs, and you know that look and that beaten-up body of theirs because you went through it? How many people do you think, men and women, have come up to you and grab your soul, and you watch them transform months, maybe a year later, whatever, into a person that is calm and heartwarming? How many people have you come across in your job doing that?
Oh, I'd have to say hundreds.
Oh, my God, that's the best. Because I have to tell, everybody knows I'm in radio and such, but my second love is recovery. I mean, that's really my first love. Let me rephrase that. My first love is my sobriety, and every single day I wake up sober. But I love radio, too, but I have to do that as a job, and I love doing it as a job, but I don't have any experience in recovery. And I tell you, I've talked to Cindy before. I would love to be able to have an opportunity to help people like you, like you've been doing, like you've been taking care of. It's got to be the most rewarding.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
It is.
It really is amazing. And
and this is why...
There's just something that... People that are cut of the same cloth, which we are, even though we're sober, we're cut of the same cloth of those people, So when they know that you know, and they know that they're safe with you, and that they can tell you, and that you genuinely want to help them, and of course there's people that, like, come across my path and then go back out. But they resurface, and when they resurface, they say, "I remember what you said," or "I kept your phone number," or "I was looking for you. I needed your resources." Sometimes they just pour their heart out to you, and you know what? That's a great start too. So we plant the seed. We never know when it'll bloom. We hope it's sooner than later. But
stop me if I'm wrong, and a lot of times I am. Stop me if I'm wrong, but you also know. That doing this job comes with the good, the very good, and the bad. The bad, like she just said, you may never see someone again. They go out, unfortunately, and unfortunately, in our damn disease, some people wind up homeless or in jail or death.
Yes.
That, and I don't know how you deal with that because I don't know how you deal with the hundreds and hundreds of people you come across in your life without not taking each one in your heart and not taking it personally if somebody fails.
Well, I mean,
put it this way. It's like my person that does my hair. I come in, every 3 or 4 months and they're like, "Good Lord, your hair still looks terrible." And they have to cut my hair and then they have to go home and
right.
I laugh because of that scenario. What I say to you is from my heart, if I were in your position, I would find it nearly impossible not to be attached to every single soul that comes to me and sits in front of me who's in desire of getting help.
And, you know, and funny you should bring that up. I think even in my line of work and just in life in general, my heart is so big. Like, I think I do get attached to people.
Oh, I know you
do. Which is probably where all the hurt and the trauma came from when people left and people weren't there for me. And
yeah.
People that I loved weren't available. And then that vodka bottle was all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's boundaries, good boundaries, good caring. It all kind of goes hand in hand. But, you know, we do the best, as with all things, we do the best we can and just stay consistent. So.
Well, when did the light bulb go off in your head about writing a book? Good Lord, she's an author. Not only does she save lives and with her huge heart and goes out and chews a lot of gum because now she's a gum fan.
Correct.
good grief. How does the light bulb go off in your head about writing a book?
You know, I remember, so the name of my book is called, and it'll be published in the next 2 months. It is called The Red Cup Diary.
The Red Cup
and I
Diary.
Knew the title of the book way back in like 2002.
Yeah.
And I remember just having those red cups, those solo cups, like in the house. And, you know, I'd rinse it out, but I'd make another drink in it. And I'd rinse it out, and I'm like thinking, this thing's trash. Like, it's supposed to be used once. So it was always kind of an inside joke for me. Like, those things are not meant to be recycled. But
right.
Fast forward to the pandemic in 2020. So March 2020, you know, because prior to the pandemic, I was working two jobs. I was working my day job, and then I'd work as a DUI counselor at night. And that was, a lot of that was, you know, my boys were in high school, and they were off going off to college, and I had grandchildren coming in, you know, so it was really, I mean, the money was decent, and it was really important to me to make sure that I covered my family.
Okay.
But then the pandemic hit. And for my day job, we got sent home to work from home. Here's a laptop, go work from home. And by the way, we're going to start doing all these Zoom meetings. And then the night job, obviously, because people couldn't be in the building, they kept the full-time employees and they put the part-time employees on hold. So, and even during the pandemic, my career grew. It was just amazing. But so here we are, March 2020, and, you know, we get through the year. I got a promotion. January 2021 comes, and because I'm up so early, back to this up so early thing.
Yeah, right.
You know, I just really, I had some extra time on my hands, and I had all this burning in my heart to really tell somebody, because I don't know about you when you drink, but one of the things that used to really, that I can look back on is that in the middle of the night, I'd be listening to music. In fact, my kids will ask me these days, you know, how do you know this music? And I go, because I would be, every night when they were asleep, I would be sitting there drinking, of course, but yeah, listening to music, trying to figure out what I would do different the next day to not have such a crappy day as we did the day before, you know?
So, right.
Like, I was always trying to come up with a plan. So anyway, fast forward to January 2021, and here I am up early, and I just really, really wanted to be able to help people. You know, I wasn't seeing clients in person like we were because of the pandemic, and I just pulled up a Word document, and I started tap, tap, tapping on the keyboard, and 4 months later, I had this book written.
So it's final. And, it's done.
Oh, it's final. It's done. It's put in digital form. I need to ship it off to the publisher. I've shipped it off to a professional editor, who she was amazing. And if you go to my website, cdcasa.info, you'll see my editor's name. You'll see the lady who made a beautiful cover. I told her what I wanted. I told her I wanted on the cover a picture of a lady cleaning with a drink in her hand, because that, prior to the intervention, is what I did. I'd be cleaning the house with a drink in my hand. So, yes, my book, The Red Cup Diaries, I've written under the name C.D. Casa, just to protect everybody involved. Everybody's name's been changed. But it's my story. It's my story of being in bondage to bitterness, resentment, anger, alcohol, substances, all of that to my breakthrough of just like, thank you, I can breathe.
Pretty exciting stuff. It's called The Red Cup Diary. And like she said, C.D. Casa is her author's name, and she's done that for what she just said to protect many people, kind of like myself, because one of the chapters, that I think it's chapter six, goofy-looking DJ, is actually me. She just she just didn't want to rat it out the day that we met at the banquet.
Yes.
Isn't that true, or did you hopefully take that chapter out, I'm hoping?
I took that chapter out. My editor took that chapter out.
So I want you to promise to all of our audience right now, and I'm going to make sure I got you on tape, that when the Red Cup Diary is ready to purchase, I imagine you can go to Amazon or any of those big places, and it's ready. Will you send us through There Is a Way Out on our Facebook page with a picture of the cover and details with a link where people can go and order this thing?
I would be honored to. I absolutely will. Absolutely will. You know, this, I feel like as a new author, in fact, I just went to my first writer's conference, if you will, last weekend.
Here comes the bragging part.
I mean, it was so eye-opening because I learned so many things. I learned that the genre that I'm writing under is called Quit Lit.
Oh.
Quit Lit, right. It's a whole genre. Huh. I had no idea.
Wow.
And I felt like, oh my gosh, because they gave, you know, there was so many little seminars and stuff, and they gave us so many great tips about publishing and all this great stuff. And I kind of felt like, okay, I am way behind track, but I'm not going to let that distract me. I feel like the writing of the book was very therapeutic and easy.
Yeah.
I feel like finding an amazing editor was pretty easy. I feel like finding the lady who put it all in digital form and did the cover was doable. But this whole publishing thing and this Instagram marketing it's a new skill I'm trying to learn. So please be patient with me. But here's my, I do have my website, cdcasa.info.
Okay.
I do have a Facebook page, it's CD Casa, and then my Instagram is cdcasa2023. So,
all right,
try to find me, add me, and help me like grow my followers.
cdcasa.info.
Yes.
You can find her on Facebook as what?
CD Casa.
I have a quick question. You probably haven't pondered this yet, because I know you've been so busy cruising around the state in your own jet, like hobnobbing with all the other kind of, I'm a new author now, The Red Cup Diary. Have you heard it? I've got some gum. I've got some gum here. Would you like some? Listen.
Yes.
When this book becomes a movie, who will play your lead role?
You know what? That's an amazing question, but I hope it would be my beautiful, gorgeous daughter that never gave up on me.
Oh, what's her name?
I probably shouldn't say.
Oh, sorry. Okay, that was dumb. I mean, I wasn't sure. You know, it's okay to keep Cindy's very private, which is all right. One of the things that I like so much about, and I hope, Cindy, that you like my There Is a Way Out page on Facebook, is you can watch and read and listen to stuff without anyone knowing you're in there. And I have that happen a lot. I've had people sign up, and I'm only the one that knows because I'm the administrator. You can do this with an anonymous flair. You don't have to
amazing.
Yeah, it really is. If anybody who's listening to this has friends and they want to be a part of There Is a Way Out, it's on my Facebook page. All you got to do is, I think, just send me an invite or something like that. It's free. But I understand. So when I asked your daughter's name, I apologize. I'm just so used to talking to you. But how old is she?
She's about to turn 35.
Big part of your life.
Huge part. Another one of the amazing rewards of, so not just did I get sober and get free of that bondage, but I know today that I broke the cycle. Like, I broke that cycle and generational curse, because my children, they're all young adults now.
Yeah.
They can have a beer.
Yeah.
And then they go on and they go to work for the next 3 months and they go to a Padre game and maybe have a beer, but they don't have to. It's just amazing to watch.
And let me ask you this. To this day, because I still am amazed to this day, I'm still amazed. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. I'm jealous at some point where I can watch someone go, yeah, give me a hot dog. Give me that ice cold beer over there. Because, you know, we are not going to lie and say an ice cold beer, you know, still sounds refreshing. However, we halt those brakes right there and say, ain't going down that road anymore. You know, as much as we think about it, that we do every once in a while think, boy, a Guinness beer would be hitting the spot right now. But that's where it ends quick. And it's cool for you to see your family and other friends that, once again, I'll use that term normie. Normies are anybody,
anybody
who can have a beer and 4 days later say, you know what, I haven't had a drink all week. I don't need to.
Right, right.
And wouldn't you say, Cindy, that sometimes we get a little jealous for the fact that people can.
Nah.
And then,
no.
And there's your answer. Eh, because we don't need it. It's
no.
I never would have thought,
you know,
I would say that 16 or 17 years ago. Nah, because it was so part of my life. You know?
Nah, I just like to see, like I said, people be happy, healthy, and any way I can help that, I definitely try. My dearest friends will tell you that that they know that I'm there for them when they need them. Same thing with my family. And Bromo, I got to tell you too, your heart for helping people and people in recovery and sharing this experience, strength and hope is admirable. And yeah, definitely. You, what you do for the community, thank you.
You don't need to thank me. You know, I do this because I'm my way of giving back, because I'm so grateful for the gift that was given to me by my higher power, God, who saved
me,
who gave me another chance, because he easily could have had me stroked down the hallway in San Diego at 5:30 in the morning at work at radio station. You know, I am so lucky that I get to hear stories like yours and other people that have been on my podcast. I want people to listen, not for me, but I want people to hear the stories like you. And the Red Cup Diary that's coming out is going to be a book for anybody that can read and cherish it and relate to it in their own way.
Yes. Yeah. And there is, you know, and another thing I'll say, any area you're at, and I'm not sure about like out in the, you know, more rural areas, but there is so many resources out there available.
Well, let
today.
Me stop you real quick. First of all, we're in a big city here, Cindy. We don't have a haystack across the street.
No, I'm not talking about where you're at, Shirley.
What are you talking about? Okay.
I'm talking about there could be somebody in the middle of,
right.
Oh, I don't know.
I know what you're saying.
There's plenty of, even San Diego has plenty of rural space, but yeah, there is so much help out there available, and it doesn't have to be something that turns your whole world upside down. You know, if you are curious or if you need someone to talk to, and even since COVID, there's self-help meetings online. There's
spiritually-based
meetings online. There's
There's apps you can download. I mean, there's just a billion of them. Yeah, you're so right. You can go on a Zoom meeting anywhere, I believe, at any time around the country, right?
Absolutely.
Isn't that something?
It is pretty amazing, and I think it's, you know, I mean, for the reason that it started because of the pandemic, but I think it's something that's super helpful. Even all the therapy, the mental health therapy that's being done via telehealth these days is pretty amazing, because sometimes it takes, you know, people won't leave their house to get help, but if they'll get help in their house, and then that's a start, you know?
Yeah, well, listen, I really appreciate the time that you've spent on here. I've been trying to get you on forever. This is Cindy.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, she goes to cdcasa.info. You can get all the information you need from her there. You can go on Facebook, which I encourage, CD Casa. The Red Cup Diary is the name of the book, and it's going to be out. The Red Cup Diaries.
Diaries, yep.
And that's due out when, in a couple months?
Yeah, I'd say by early summer.
All right, early summer, the Red Cup Diaries. It's going to be out. She's going to actually send us more info and a link when it does come out so you can order it. Here's the thing about Cindy. What she does for a living, she does from her heart 100%. She does for the fact of giving back. She does because this lifetime for those, for anyone who is going through it and is telling themselves, man, I am trapped. I've been through that. I was trapped in a hellhole I never thought I'd ever get out of. I kept expecting, like I said, to run into a stroke. I kept wondering if the shakes would go away, and they wouldn't. And there was no way out. There was no way out for me until I basically hit rock bottom and had to surrender. And I'm so grateful for the fact that I was able to. All of the people that I've had on, including Cindy today, are such an inspiration to others. Like I said, whether you're on the fence or you do have a problem, or a family member. This is another great thing. A family member. You don't need to get 30 people together in a room. Why don't you try to have them listen to some of these podcasts and maybe something will click and maybe they will give themselves a chance. Cindy, I appreciate you. You want to say anything else to anybody?
I just want to really, you know, I think you ended this perfectly. You know, there is help. Like Bromo's podcast, there is a way out. My hope, my prayer for all anybody struggling is that you're not alone. Just reach out. I remember thinking like, oh my gosh, all this work seems so scary, but it is so amazing and beautiful on the other side of the disease of addiction or alcoholism. So well, give yourself a chance. You can always go back if you don't like it.
You blew your chance there because I would have, if had I just thrown that to you in a perfect setup, I would have said, well, I'm going to get into my private jet now and fly off to New York and hobnob with some other big shot authors and talk about my Red Cup Diaries. And maybe I'll have one of those book signing parties where we'll have tea and crumpets and we'll sit around.
That's all to come. That is definitely all to come. And I'll be sure to come back on when that all happens.
Yeah, me a favor. Yeah, that's a good idea. Do me a favor. When the book comes out, let's have you on for another segment, just strictly talking about the book and what's your favorite part about the book and all that. But again, the Red Cup Diaries is going to be coming out. And there's a cool picture on the front. And like I said, there's a chapter of me in there about the day I met a goofy radio disc jockey. Just kidding.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a blast. Cindy, you hang on with me real quick. And there you go. That's why I do this. That's why I do There Is a Way Out. Not for me. In fact, a lot of times I wish I could go back and edit a lot of the stuff that I say and I interrupt my guests and stuff. But Cindy and so many others that have been on this podcast do such a great thing for others. And what she does for a living, I admire so much. And she wrote a book about it. And again, I stress this part. If anybody out there that you may think drinks too much, uses too much, if you're watching the world spin out of control, I'm telling you, take a couple of minutes, an hour or two, and listen to some of these podcasts, because there is a way out.